Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Tuesday, December 12, 2023. Human Rights Watch is urging the U.S. government to take action to protect civilians caught in Sudan's eight-month-long conflict.
When you have such serious violations of international humanitarian law, it is critical for the international response to mirror, to echo the scale of the abuses we are talking about. So what we would like to see is a much more robust international and regional response.
And a South Sudanese minister says the country needs a national land policy to help resolve land conflicts.
This land, draft land policy is coming as a very timely moment. There are other reforms that are ongoing in the constitutional making process. And I think this is the opportunity for South Sudan to be able to take to ensure issues of land are properly anchored in the new constitution.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We begin in Sudan, where both of Sudan's warring parties have rejected last week's determination by the U.S. Secretary of State that elements of the Sudan Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have committed war crimes in their eight-month-long conflict. Secretary of State Antony Blinken stated last week, quote, Based on the State Department's careful analysis of the law and available facts, I have determined that members of the SAF and the RSF have committed war crimes in Sudan. I have also determined that members of the RSF and allied militias have committed crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing, end quote. Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs welcomed the condemnation of the alleged crimes committed by the RSF, but dismissed allegations against the army as baseless. It called the Blinken statement indiscriminate allegations that equate the armed forces with the rebel militia that is responsible for unleashing horrific violence, death, and destruction. The ministry also said the State Department's determination that the army has committed war crimes ignores, quote, the duty and the right of the armed forces, the legitimate national army, to defend the country and the people, end quote. The Rapid Support Forces press office also issued a statement over the weekend saying, we concur with the U.S. Department of State that this war has had tragic impact on Sudanese civilians. We advocate for the removal of the terrorist former regime, especially from within SAF, to enable the democratic transition to continue. It said, however, the statement fails to acknowledge the true instigators of the war. It overlooks the fact that the National Congress Party, a terrorist organization that exerts complete control over SAF leadership, started this war. The RSF categorically denied accusations of sexual violence committed by its forces, saying, we take this claim seriously and remain open to collaborating with independent third parties to investigate this matter, ensuring transparency and fairness. We will not shield anyone found to have been involved in such crimes, end quote. The RSF also denied allegations of ethnic cleansing in Darfur, stating, it is a grave misfortune that our efforts to liberate Darfur, especially West Darfur, from the National Congress Party are portrayed wrongfully as ethnic cleansing. Sudan's conflict has killed more than 12,000 people and displaced over 6 million people, according to the United Nations. Human Rights Watch is calling on the United States government to take what it calls concrete action to stop abuses after Washington recently determined that Sudan's warring parties have committed atrocities in the past 8 months. On Monday, Human Rights Watch said the U.S. must ensure that the perpetrators are held accountable for their actions. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
The United States State Department said last week that the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces have committed atrocities. Letitia Beida is the Deputy Director for Africa at Human Rights Watch, who is based in Rome, Italy. She says while it's good that the U.S. government has acknowledged that the warring parties in Sudan have committed crimes against humanity in Darfur, acknowledgement alone is meaningless unless accompanied by actions by the U.S. government. Beida says now the U.S. government should take specific actions to protect civilians in Sudan and ensure the perpetrators of abuses are held to account.
Actions which are, of course, obligations in many ways when you have such serious violations of international humanitarian law. It is critical for the international response to mirror, to echo the scale of the abuses we are talking about. So what we would like to see is a much more robust international and regional response. The response so far has been limited and has in no shape or form hampered, tackled the root causes of the violence, the cycles of impunity in the country.
Beida says Human Rights Watch expects the U.S. government to initiate robust consultations with the international community to explore viable ways to protect civilians in Sudan.
So we would like the U.S. rallying support at the level of the Security Council, but also in terms of engagement with IGAD member states and also the African Union to try and come forward with a new civilian protection force to be deployed to Darfur, where the needs of communities are immediate and urgent.
Beida says the U.S. government and the rest of the international community should impose sanctions on individuals responsible for serious crimes, including targeting the resources that allow perpetrators to commit crimes.
We would also like them to follow up and follow through with some of the individual sanctions that they have already imposed on individuals responsible for some of these abuses. That needs to continue. It also needs to go hand in hand with public condemnation of the existing arms embargo in Darfur.
Human Rights Watch calls for including civilian voices, such as displaced communities, human rights and women rights defenders, in any discussion about the situation in Sudan, and in particular in Darfur. Beida says many of the problems in Sudan are a result of the international community ignoring the concerns of the communities.
A very good example. In 2020, when the Security Council voted to remove the peacekeeping mission from Darfur, many of the internally displaced communities there, notably in West Darfur, were warning that removing the peacekeeping forces would remove a key deterrent to attacks. And we saw almost immediately an uptake in serious attacks taking place in the West Darfur state. Those voices need to be part of all the discussions going forward more broadly on issues of civilian protections. What are the needs? You know, these are the communities who know what they need, but also what do they see for the future and what does justice look like for those who have faced these abuses?
Human Rights Watch says other concrete actions should include taking issues to the UN Security Council, including pressing for a council visit to Eastern Chad to meet survivors of atrocities. In addition, the rights body says the U.S. should signal greater backing for the International Criminal Court's investigation of current crimes committed in Darfur. Human Rights Watch also called on the U.S. to increase support for independent evidence collection and other preparatory work and accountability for serious international crimes in Sudan. The rights body also called on the U.S. government to increase funding for Sudanese civil society organizations, human rights defenders, and democracy groups as they are key to building a lasting peace when conflict ends. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
A South Sudanese minister says a lack of a national land policy is driving rampant land grabs across the country and is urging lawmakers to adopt a proposed land policy to reduce violence that stems from disputes over land. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
Some South Sudanese lawmakers, land experts in government, and United Nations representatives gathered in Juba recently to review the draft land policy before it is officially presented in the National Legislative Assembly. The 56-page document highlights the challenges facing land governance issues in the country. The proposed policy states that all land in the country is owned by the people of South Sudan and its usage shall be regulated by the government. However, some South Sudanese say the phrase owned by South Sudanese people is too vague and shall be revised to say it is owned by South Sudanese community. The proposed legislation also spells out how to implement the policy. South Sudan Minister of Land, Housing and Urban Development, Michael Chanjek, says the absence of the national land policy is the main driver of land-related conflict and illegal land grabs.
Land policy is one of the things that's if we really adapted it properly, it would reduce some of our problems, especially the ongoing communal fighting or the what we call now land grabbing. So our technical team will be available through all this process, and until the day that we are presenting this to you in the parliament.
Research conducted by Ministry of Land, Housing and Urban Development found there are several challenges to enforcing land governance, including weak land administration and management, as well as lack of consensus on who owns the land. Other challenges include displacement resulting from conflict, disaster and illegal occupation of land. Peter Dokuwani, Assistant Dean at the Department of Land Management and Urban Planning at the University of Juba, agrees that having no national land policy has caused chaos in South Sudan's land administration.
The absence of the policy has brought about a huge mess in land administration. Now, the passing of it, if it is done, will culminate into making the South Sudan Land Act review of what is existing now, and it may improve land management in general.
Lawmaker Jackson Bagu says if and when a national land policy is adopted, it would influence the review of other existing laws such as the Land Act and the 2009 local government.
If we pass this document as soon as possible, it's going to pass to pave the way or to influence the process of developing two important documents. One, it will influence the review of the Land Act 2009, which already is there, but we are going to review it based on the new land policy which we have discussed and which is going to be passed by the Parliament.
Dialogue over South Sudan national land policy began in 2006 before the country's independence. Samuel Doe is the country representative for the UN Development Programme in South Sudan.
This land draft land policy is coming at a very timely moment. There are other reforms that are ongoing that are in the constitutional making process. And I think this is the opportunity for South Sudan to be able to take to ensure issues of land are properly anchored in the new constitution.
The proposed land policy incorporates components of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, the 2011 South Sudan Transitional Constitution, the African Union Frameworks and Guidelines on Land Policy, and the 2018 Revitalized Peace Deal. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba. Some South Sudanese lawmakers, land experts in government, and United Nations representatives gathered in Juba recently to review the draft land policy before it.
We apologize for that technical error. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at contested elections in Zimbabwe. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's a bad habit that you have struggled to give up?
Bad habit. I love sleeping a lot. Yeah, that's my bad habit. I love sleeping. Sometimes I fail to catch up on time because of sleep.
That habit of being jealous to my wife, yes, that one. I've tried to be to control myself so that I should not be jealous of her, but I do fail.
a short temper. Because I think that it is a genetic, so I cannot give up.
I tend to overreact when my kids do something wrong, and I end up regretting the consequences of my actions after giving them too tough punishments.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Zimbabwe's opposition has challenged the results of last weekend's by-elections, describing them as a sham designed to give the ruling ZANU-PF a tighter grip on power. The Opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC, also says an obscure political figure, Zengezo Chabangu, who was responsible for removing CCC members from parliament, is not the party's interim secretary general as claimed. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's party, ZANU-PF, is just 10 seats away from securing a two-thirds majority in parliament that would allow it to change the constitution. Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio, discussed with VOA's Yahir Swahib the politics of the weekend and whether ZANU-PF wants to change the constitution.
Well, I don't think the constitution can easily be changed, you know, because ZANU-PF has a majority in parliament. A lot of stakeholders are involved always when the constitution is supposed to be changed. And I think that is in the constitution itself. It's just like politics being played, that ZANU-PF wants to change the constitution. It has been confirmed by the vice president of Zimbabwe, General Chiwengwa, that that's not the goal of ZANU-PF. And what is really happening, it's just like confusion mostly from the opposition side. They don't have structures. They don't have anybody whom they can say, this is the secretary general. And that opportunity has been taken by somebody who is now claiming to be an acting secretary general, recalling members of parliament. And once, parliament receives that message of recalling party members, they have to act according to the constitution of Zimbabwe. So the blame game is there. Of course, ZANU-PF is a party that's so much old and rooted into Zimbabwean politics. I believe 100% that it has infiltrated the opposition to the point where they can actually do whatever they want, like maybe, these recalls. But I don't think it's something we can blame one party. Say the opposition must be organized. They don't have that.
Professor, let's talk about this obscure political figure you mentioned. It's Sengezo Chibangu, who declared himself the CCC's interim secretary general. And who is he? And he is actually making a difference on the by-election.
Yeah, he can be genuine, because according to what he said, well, they all know him, the leadership of CCC. And he was there when MDC was formed and then CCC was formed. It's only maybe now that they are, with what he is doing, they are claiming that they don't know him. But you look at the leadership of CCC, so to dismiss him without having someone we know is substantive, I don't think that works at all. The opposition brought it to themselves.
So why would CCC leader Nelson Chamisa, a former preacher who protested that Chabunga was not a party member and that no expulsions had been agreed, why would he say that?
So he should exercise his powers if he really meant it. He's just saying that, because he has to say it. It's politics. He can't keep quiet. But he obviously knows the person, and he can't blame himself for not having a Congress for the party to choose people who are going to be substantive. So he's trying to find a scapegoat and blame this and that. He's blaming Chabangu, he's blaming ZANU-PF. The only person he's not blaming is himself, which is not being a good politician.
And lastly, Professor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's party ZANU-PF is just 10 seats away from securing a two-thirds majority in parliament. That would allow it to change the constitution. You think they're going to get the majority and then actually change the constitution? You think that they're heading that way?
Well, I think definitely they are going to get the majority. But, you know, changing the constitution, as I said before, I don't think it's an easy thing. That depends with only parliamentarians. You know, a lot of stakeholders are involved in changing the constitution. They need to change the constitution. And what part of the constitution do they want to change? Some people have said, well, they want to extend the term of the president, and the vice president said, no, that's not going to change. So I don't know what part of the constitution, you know, may be changed because they have the majority, but I don't think that's the goal for ZANU-PF. They will definitely enjoy the majority and do whatever they want, but not touching much of the constitution, because I don't think some people in ZANU-PF want to go that way.
That's Elliot Masotti, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio. He was in conversation with my colleague Yahia Suhib. High-level experts and innovators at AfriNex, a conference hosted by the Atlantic Council and global development company DAI, are showcasing the strong business case for investing in African markets and the importance of situating investments and other partnerships squarely in local contexts. You will also, my colleague Anthony Labruto, who is at the venue, will also share perspectives on what lies ahead for the African continent, including the rise of power of its youth, the impact of digitalization, and the threat of climate change. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thank you very much, Dabil. Thank you for having me.
Let's just begin by asking, what is AfriNex?
So AfriNex is a group and hosted by the Atlantic Council, but more specifically, this AfriNex conference is looking to address really on a wider scale what's already being done by companies and public institutions throughout the Western world, and that's a greater cooperation. You know, bridging gaps in education, human development, technology, you know, things that are happening really on a small scale or a case-by-case basis now between the West and Africa, and conference goers would really like to see more of. And a point I'd like to make, too, is that this conference is also including members of the African diaspora right alongside embassy staff, think tank members, policy writers that are actually listening to and asking questions to them. You know, things like, how is Africa conducting business? What can Americans do better to participate in African markets without overwhelming them or, you know, completely dominating them as they may have in the past? But the key theme here really from this conference is a more collective approach and increasing business and creating social change in Africa rather than a case-by-case basis.
So that's what they hope to address at this conference, to come up with some coherent approach to investing in African markets.
Absolutely, yes. And funny enough, I was speaking with an art curator right before I stepped in here, who was telling me that there really wasn't a ton of interest really within African art, African culture, really until post-pandemic. And now that things like Afrobeats have really taken a place in the Western world, there is now so much more interest in our art and, you know, seeing where that is going, you know, with technology, with culture, with, you know, scientific advancement has really, really been encouraging.
You mentioned Afrobeat. It seems like it's a two-way street here. It's not just investment flowing in one direction.
Yes, absolutely. And this investment, I think, at least from my perspective here, is that it's been a lot more Western-centric towards Africa. But I think, unlike the conferences in the past, is that there is African diaspora here telling them what to do, how to increase their market share, how to increase their presence in Africa without completely dominating it.
And this is the second time you mentioned members of the diaspora. What is the importance of involving them? I mean, you would think it's easier for businesses to go into Africa, African countries, and talk to private sector, governments, businesses. Why? What role can the diaspora play?
Members of the diaspora, really particularly in Washington, D.C., have this strong and powerful connections to each other and back home to their communities in Africa that Western organizations are finally noticing. you know, these members are doing, you know, as I said, you know, really amazing things throughout the country, throughout America and the Western world, creating art, developing technology, holding public offices, and becoming journalists in really their own way and really reinventing and adapting many of the systems to their own benefit. And really at the forefront of this, too, has been, you know, younger diaspora members with access to greater communication tools back home, you know, cell phones, you know, in, you know, information technology. The future has really proven limitless for them, and also having a savviness to learn that technology, too, to use it, to develop it further at a quicker pace, was something on par that we would even see at a Western institution.
You did mention that the West so far has dominated its, you know, in this relationship with Africa. But have Western companies and institutions, you know, been really successful in tapping into modern African markets, or are they just waking up to the potential?
I think, you know, now, I think conferences like this, they are finally realizing the potential of Africa and particularly African youth. And going back to that first point that I made, you know, the Western companies and institutions, you know, yeah, they're already on the continent, but, you know, why not reframe the way that they're doing this? And particularly with bigger and medium-sized corporations, you know, how exactly are these companies doing business, and what can they do to increase African participation, you know, both in the diaspora and in the home markets? And, you know, while they've completely taken them over, you know, particularly like within the colonial period, now there's more of a, you know, okay, we're open to listening, and now we realize the potential that's already there without having to do anything.
And from the discussion, just finally, from the discussion you tuning into right now and the people you're interacting with, what is the sense, what does the future look like? Is it bright? And what is the place of the youth in it, African youth?
Oh, and African youth certainly are the future, as, you know, as I've been seeing throughout this, you know, there are youth-led conversations. There are our own colleague, Jackson Bunganyu, hosts a youth-oriented show, also, you know, driving this conversation. And so while the products and takeaways, you know, won't really be instant, you know, we've seen Afrobeats, you know, be really nothing within the Western sense to now this really popular music genre. It won't be instant, but the fact that young diaspora members are here and saying what many listeners on the continent already know, you know, they know the markets, the people, what's needed for them, and they can make them popular for Western audiences. And whether or not, you know, enough of these Western institutions, Western organizations are listening and kind of wake up and make those changes, we'll certainly have to see.
Thank you very much, Anthony Labruta, for joining us live on South Sudan in Focus and for your perspective.
Thank you very much, Nabil.
That was my colleague, Anthony Labruta. He was live from the AfriNex conference at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. And that's all we have for you this Tuesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We leave you now with General Paulino and the song Shekelmanga. I am your host, Nabil Biagio, in Washington. On behalf of our producers, Gwen Uten and David Vandy, and engineer Cornelius Tanner, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Yeah.